Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. Today we feature CEO Steve Durbin's conversation with Stephen Poloz, a world-renowned economist who served as governor of the Bank of Canada from 2013 through 2020. Steve and Stephen discuss some of the themes Poloz addresses in his recently released book, The Next Age of Uncertainty: How the World Can Adapt to a Riskier Future. They discuss communication in the midst of crisis, how the Fourth Industrial Revolution compares to past momentous technological change, and managing risk and staying resilient amidst global turmoil.
So, Stephen, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. You have been described as one of the world's foremost economists. You've got over 40 years' experience in economic and investment research, forecasting, banking, policymaking. And of course, you were governor of the Bank of Canada for 7 years. Christine Lagarde, who was president of the European Central Bank and, of course, managing director of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, has also described you as one of the most experienced economists that she has ever worked with, who's never lost touch with the world around you. So huge plaudits there. No pressure at all in terms of what we're going to be talking about for the next 20, 30 minutes or so. But I'm intrigued by how you really had such a stellar career as an economist and, of course, ended up as being the governor of the Bank of Canada. So let's start there. Did you always set out wanting to be an economist? Was that something that you sort of set your stall out from a young age?
No, to be honest, Steve, I never knew the first thing about it. Even in high school, I was not exposed to the subject of economics. You know, I had a pretty modest upbringing in Oshawa, which is near Toronto. Father was a tool and die maker and that sort of thing. And so I was always being pushed to become a doctor as a kid. And you know, if your parents tell you something often enough, eventually you begin to nod your head and say, yeah, I guess I should be a doctor. So I went to Queen's University with the full intention to go through pre-med coursework, you know, and then move on to take medicine and become a doctor and return to my hometown and be a doctor there. But when you do that, you get to take all this science and math at the beginning, those first 2 years, and they leave room for one option, one thing you could choose out of the entire book of courses being offered, what a religion, philosophy, whatever you want. And I didn't know what to do. I thought I would just take another math course because that's what I was good at. And one of my friends there just said, well, why don't you try economics? I heard that's pretty good. And I read about it and I thought, that does sound pretty good. So I took it and I fell in love with it. It's a funny story. I never would have encountered it. So then I switched to economics and just took enough of the sciences that I had to in order to apply to med school to keep my options open. But after 2 years of economics, I knew what I wanted to do, much to the chagrin of my parents. So that's when I switched to economics. It was around the second year. But you know, it was really my first year when I learned what the Bank of Canada was and what it did. And I thought, man, that's powerful stuff. You know, I wouldn't mind doing that. You know, I wouldn't mind working there. You could help a lot of people all at once, as opposed to just helping people one at a time as a doctor.
Right. And of course, governor of the Bank of Canada, absolutely huge job. People listening to this will be thinking, how do you find the time to just get anything done with managing all of those different economic policies and so on? But what were the main takeaways from your time as governor? Because as I say, it was 7 years. It was what, 2013 to 2020, something like that? So that's interesting, correct. Period as well.
Yes, well, it was an interesting period. We basically began with still fighting the last war, which was the global financial crisis. The economy was still well short of where it needed to be. And then, of course, ended off with the COVID crisis. And so, but I guess my big takeaways, there are many. It is possible for that job, any governor's job, and I'm sure other governors will find the same thing. It's possible for it to be all-consuming, that you could literally spend all your waking time reading more and getting more briefed and understanding even more detail. Or you can rely on a team, which is more my model, and discover that actually there's so many people around you that want all the same things that you can get enormous amounts done without actually destroying your home life. So I think I did manage to find something, a bit of a medium in there. But if you're asking about, there's of course high points and low points. And most of the low points I kind of associate with the media, not because, you know, I have lots of high points with media too. It's just that the low points were points from which the media kind of went off on a tangent. Or, you know, you attract criticism because every word, every nuance is so scrutinized that my style of communication was a little more informal. I mean, I would say to you, well, you know, this is going to happen probably by the end of the year or around the end of the year. And you'd say, oh, around the end of the year. Okay, fine. And then a few minutes later in the same conversation, I would say, you know, sure, you know, late this year, early next year, which in my mind is still around the end of the year.
Right.
But literally not the same words. And I would be criticized for not giving a clear message. Yeah, you know, so I found some of those things a bit annoying, but the power of the office, the ability to literally anticipate something that's going to happen to the economy, react in advance, get it done, despite, you know, opposition or criticism at the time, and then to be proven correct, that's very fulfilling stuff. You really at the end think, you know, I actually did some good by sticking my neck out and taking a bit of heat. And afterwards, people say, yeah, you're right. That turned out, you know, that's very fulfilling stuff. The feeling in that office is that it matters so much. That's the thing. Every day, even the most silly little arguments you get into, don't forget the big picture. This really matters.
And a lot of the things, I'm just sitting here listening to you, you know, a lot of the things that you're talking about there are the sorts of challenges that very many people listening to this podcast will be familiar with. So, you know, chief executive of an organization, perhaps there has been certainly in the space that the ISF operates, you know, cyber, maybe there's been a breach, the need for clarity, the need to be specific. And some people may be sitting here thinking, well, you know, at least there's somebody else out there who's been challenged as well in terms of having what they've said be misinterpreted and so on. Yeah. But let's dig into that in a little bit more detail, because I'm interested in that sort of crisis management piece, because you must have had situations when you were governor where you did have to perhaps sharpen your focus or, you know, set aside some of, as you said, some of that more informal way of talking. What advice would you give to, say, chief executive listening to this who at some point in time are going to have to deal with potentially cyber breaches, that kind of thing, where the media are going to be, frankly, all over them?
Yes. Well, I can sympathize. I mean, I've never faced a crisis of that sort, which to me, if I put myself into a CEO's chair, that feels existential. I mean, you really, the whole company perhaps hangs in the balance. And it's not just the media. There's a big army of shareholders out there ready to pounce. And so in my experience, I've always benefited by turning people back to the big picture. You know, yes, it's important to be very precise, to listen to your advisors and make sure that you've given a very clear statement of where the company stands at this moment and what you're doing. I think transparency usually pays. In fact, I might as well say it always pays. I really don't know of a case where transparency kind of backfired, as long as it's true transparency. And so in that same vein, being transparent, being quick about it, and being as clear as possible. But don't forget that you're just human. And I think people identify with that too. So reminding people of the big picture and reassuring them, I think paid off on, you know, the COVID crisis is an example where, you know, to be honest, it never really developed into a financial crisis because most central banks were quite out there in front of all of that. And governments besides, much better than they did in 2008, by the way. And so as a result, you know, they kind of got diffused quickly. So there are lessons right there that you can diffuse a crisis by taking quick action as opposed to just talking about it. So I'm very happy when I look back at that. You know, there's a couple of times where people were asking me, well, you know, are you going to this extent or this to that extent? You know, how big can it be? Because it's really the market participants that are testing what are the limits to the kind of intervention you'll take. And so we went with a very simple message. This is unlimited. Central bank's balance sheet is literally unlimited. So please reassure yourself. We're going to act exactly that way as if it's unlimited and we will do whatever it takes. And a firefighter has never been criticized for using too much water. And people just calm down almost instantly. But if you leave a shred of uncertainty in that dialogue, like, oh, you know, we'll do it, say, at least to this extent, or a maximum of that extent, that leaves kind of a vacuum beyond it. And I think that that doesn't pay.
You've written a book. It was published, I think, at the end of February. Certainly, that's when I managed to get a copy of it. The book is titled The Next Age of Uncertainty, How the World Can Adapt to a Riskier Future. And it maps out powerful economic forces that are really shaping our future and offers up, I think, some pretty sensible ideas as to how we might be able to master some of those. You discuss resilience. You discuss the confluence of potentially horrific events in there. And so there are probably two timely areas with which we can begin. The Ukraine, you know, in the light of some of those pretty seismic shifts that we've seen, one of the things that has certainly struck me as being unique is the isolation of Russia from SWIFT, the banking system. Tell our listeners a little bit about that from your perspective. I mean, why is that such an important way that has been chosen to try to influence the outcome of the war that's ongoing at the moment?
Sure. Well, that's always been considered, you know, the ultimate financial weapon. And it's become, over the years, even more powerful than in the past. And I don't have to remind your audience how interconnected everything has become.
Right.
And so, you know, like the statistics on international travel is kind of an indicator of just how interconnected we've become. But the payment system is far more interconnected than we can imagine. And so every one of those little lines that you might draw on a diagram connecting things financially to each other suddenly can be cut off just by eliminating one very key platform that connects the major banks to one another. And that turns out to be very powerful. And, you know, I thought it was the ultimate weapon that would be deployed. And then, they thought of another one that I hadn't actually pictured working before. And that was also to cut off the Russian central bank,
right,
which is an even more intimate network, one that in normal ebb and flow of business, you wouldn't even think about. It's just part of the plumbing that acts in the background. But today, unlike in the past, we go back to, say, the Second World War, all central banks had their reserves, you know, in a vault in the basement. And that was, there was this massive operation in Europe to move much of the gold out of those central banks across the Atlantic to either the Federal Reserve Bank of New York or to the Bank of Canada. It was a very interesting period in history. And so, you know, that just gives you a sense of how rudimentary everything was then. But now the central banks are totally connected mm-hmm. through these platforms. So then you can isolate that. Well, it means that the vast majority of Russia's foreign exchange reserves aren't in the vault in the basement at all. And that's a very important asset to a government that's spending a lot of money on a war. You cut that off, and then their resources are limited very, very strictly. So, you know, it becomes the point where ordinary citizens now cannot conduct transactions that they're used to conducting. It means that they can't buy, let's say, bananas or it doesn't matter what, you know, things that had to be imported. They can't be paid for. And the Russian economy, similar to the Canadian economy in a way, has a lot of specialization that's sort of the, you know, commodity end of things. And you trade for everything else. So trade is existential for an economy like Russia. So the point is that cutting those things off has had a very dramatic and immediate impact. And of course, thinking about risks, you know, the side effects, if you like. And of course, every weapon that's deployed has effects both on the target and the entity that's using the weapon. That's always the case. The interconnectability goes both ways, and that's what we're seeing in commodity markets. But it also means that people, ordinary Russians, are really suffering those consequences.
When you talk there about the interconnectivity, I mean, one of the things that I think increasingly, certainly, the people that I talk to today are concerned about is supply chain issues at all levels. In your book, I think in one of the chapters on growing inequality, I'm just looking at here, you talk about how global supply chains really work. Tell us a little bit about that within the context that we've just been talking about.
Yeah, so supply chains have gotten this kind of oversimplification around them, which is not uncommon with things that are in economics. People think, well, if you're getting the stuff I'm buying, if it's coming from, I don't know, it's coming from China or if it's coming from Russia or something, well, that sounds risky nowadays. So let's just have that all done here. So that way we don't have that problem. Well, of course, for economies such as Canada or the UK, or actually almost every economy, except for the largest among us, say the United States, the United States can go along its way doing less trade than most of us because of its scale. But most of us really do depend on trade in order to sell the things we have and get the things that we want. Now, expanding that into the supply process was kind of it's about a 25-year-old phenomenon. It's basically related to when China entered the WTO and opened up the possibility to reduce costs by fragmenting your product and getting the parts from somewhere else. And so if you have a product and you need really clever, high-skilled workers to do it, but usually it's only the engineering or, let's say, one of the most important components that require that, and all the rest are kind of off-the-shelf bits and pieces. Well, those things can come from anywhere else. And so by combining those things in a global way, you can reduce the price of that final product and sell many more of them. And that creates more jobs domestically, high-paid jobs. Okay, so we're thinking about the iPad or something like this, which is produced in like 40 countries. Well, okay, so with that as a basis, now let's imagine a world where we reverse all that. We deglobalize in order to reduce risk. Well, if we do that, that's a recipe for a far more expensive iPad. And so you will sell far fewer of them, and you won't have as many of those well-paying jobs domestically in the United States as you had before. People don't think about those ramifications, unfortunately. They take for granted those past benefits of having globalized and assume that they'll just stay there when they reverse all those things. And that simply isn't true.
One of the other things you say in your book, which I found really interesting, particularly within the cyberspace, was you talked about the adjustment to new technology. And you highlight that for some people that can be actually quite catastrophic because people can get left behind.
Yeah.
And it's this inequality, I suppose, of understanding or access. And you go on to talk about the fourth industrial revolution that has, you know, an even more destructive potential than the first three, because it has the capability not only of augmenting human work, but of replacing it entirely, you say, in wide swathes of the economy. Tell us a little bit more about that. What are some of those implications?
Yes, well, there's a lot to be learned from past industrial revolutions on this. And that's, I do spend a lot of time in the book looking at those, because those forces are acting pretty well all the time, new technology acting all the time. But we've only had three big waves. The general purpose technologies have spread everywhere, being the steam engine, electricity, then the computer chip, and now artificial intelligence / digitalization. The World Economic Forum estimates, and this is not from economic modeling, by the way, it's from directly asking global CEOs, you know, how many of your jobs are going to be affected by this digitalization that you're doing? And the answer that comes back is approximately 15% of global jobs, which is a tremendous number of people. And that just doesn't mean those jobs get eliminated per se, but it means that they're just disrupted. Some of them would be eliminated, of course. And the good news in that survey is that on average, those CEOs envision creating even more jobs than that as a result. But of course, what emerges is what I call the perpetual K-shaped trajectory for the economy, where the top part of the K is doing great, growing fast, and we see it right now in the economy. And the bottom part of the K is the folks that are being dislocated or disrupted from this new technology. And this is repeated all the other times we've had industrial revolutions, so it's not new. What happens in every other industrial revolution is the folks that are in the bottom part of the K feel left behind. Of course they do. And, you know, arguably the third industrial revolution, the computer chip, this wasn't just technology. It was supplemented by the fact that it was also when we did globalization, as we just discussed in your earlier question. And so for one reason or another, many people feel they didn't participate in that general increase in prosperity that comes from either new technology or the globalization we talked about earlier. And so you get this level of disenchantment that grows, and of course it becomes political. You know, anything that people care about becomes a concern to politicians because politicians work for the people. And so what we get then is this growing income inequality, the bottom part of the K versus the top part of the K, fueling this angst, this sense of discontent at the bottom part of the K, and these folks then becoming identified with one branch of our politics. So political polarization is the natural result. In the deep past, these kinds of conditions have led to things like revolutions or civil wars. Okay, that I'm not predicting that here, but of course we see symptoms of some of that kind of political activism, we call it populism or what have you. And of course, certain politicians will tap into that and actually augment the polarization for political reasons. So it's not a healthy atmosphere. And so the good news is that every other industrial revolution has eventually benefited everyone for the reasons we described before. If you have a new technology, you deploy it, your competitor deploys it, you're in a competition with one another. So what happens is the prices of everything that use the new technology tend to fall. We get a deflationary pulse through the economy, which augments the purchasing power of everyone and gives a tremendous boost to economic growth throughout the economy and creates jobs nearby. That's to say, if you're displaced by the new technology, you may be, let's say, a truck driver and you get displaced by an automated truck. Well, people say, do I have to learn how to write code in order to get a new job, to get into the top part of the K? And the answer is no, because that general rise in prosperity creates jobs right next door to you in the trades, you know, in house building, in house renovations, in furnace repair people, you know, all those kinds of jobs that, you know, require skill sets, but are not giant leaps in skill sets.
Right. So what you're saying, I think, is that, you know, change is not necessarily a bad thing. History has shown that actually we've emerged in inverted commas, better place.
That's correct. But it takes time. And during that time, people feel like they've been left behind. And so we have this period, perhaps a long one, say 10 years or more, judging from the third industrial revolution, we could have 10 years of rising income inequality. And even if we, as politicians, we address it, let's say, to adjust the redistribution properties of our tax systems, it's not a level problem. It's a growing problem throughout that progress of the industrial revolution. And those pressures will continue to build, and we'll find it really hard to reach political consensus to deal with them. And so this is where the volatility comes from. Volatility right. comes from those interactions between those folks, the deflationary pulse that's coming, the fact they have debts, and the debts grow in impact or in value because of falling prices. Well, all those things interact to give us a very volatile kind of situation, and politics probably can't help us.
So if politics can't help us through that, what can? How do we manage through that? Because as you say, you know, it could be 10 years and that requires a degree of patience that I would say we've probably, as a society, lost.
Yes. So what I'm arguing for, and I think you would agree with this, Steve, is that understanding this now, and understanding it's not just what we see out the window today, but in many dimensions will become more volatile over the next 5-10 years, that gives us an opportunity to invest in some resilience now, right, so that we're more prepared for what might seem worse a few years from now. So, you know, how many governments around the world feel prepared for the next major crisis, given that they haven't really even finished dealing with the COVID one? Well, not many. And, you know, you see this sort of sense that, oh, well, you know, that level of debt, it's like after World War II, there was a lot of debt then too, and we kind of worked it off really slowly over time. We all managed. Yeah, well, that was a little different time. That's when the population growth accelerated and the labor force exploded in the 1960s and 70s because of the baby boom. What we face coming up is the opposite. The baby boomers are retiring, and so that'll put a lot of pressure on fiscal programs. And so they will not be able to build resilience unless they literally plan for it and make some sacrifices now to do so. And that's just the government. So I think that's going to be really hard. And so what's going to happen, I think, is that even if we get better with policies and make fiscal policies more automatic and that kind of thing, they will not be able to deal with the rising tide of risk. And that risk needs to land somewhere. And therefore, it will land on our doorsteps. That's us as individuals or us as CEOs, you know, the companies. And I think because of the growing shortage of workers in this state, companies will increasingly see it in their interests to help their employees deal with the risks that they're facing. So we may see an evolution in compensation strategy at firms, which is more about risk management and a little less about, you know, finding exactly the right salary. So perhaps a resurgence of defined benefit pension plans, for instance. We've seen them just almost disappear. That's the kind of reassurance that would really build loyalty in your workforce at a time when you're going to be facing shortages. Or for companies themselves, imagine planning your business in this much more volatile future. I think companies will come to invest far more in resilience in the form of expertise around managing risk, so that a company that can manage risk down to something more acceptable will create a lot of value for their shareholders. Right. And it won't be just having a risk report for your board and looking at a couple of tail events or tail scenarios. It'll be more like having an actual team that's charged with managing risks in the company full time, all the time, and thinking ahead, and thereby actually spending money on risk management, having a line that's, you know, an intangible investment, like what you invest in your brand or in your network.
It's an interesting point you make there, because one of the things that I see at the moment in the cyber space is a lot more discussion around this issue of risk. So for a very long time, we in the industry have talked about performing a qualitative assessment on risk. And there's been a drive over the last, I would say, 2 to 3 years to try to move that much more to quantification, because boards understand that better. You know, put a price on it. Let's understand how we're going to get something back for the amount of money that we're investing. And traditionally, cyber has been pretty poor at being able to do that. But what I'm hearing you say is that these sorts of things are going to be necessarily, as a means of differentiation anyway, going to become almost intrinsic in the way that we manage our businesses going forward. Is that what you're saying?
That is exactly what I'm saying. And to go directly to your point, that is that risk quantification has made many advances during my professional life, but it really hasn't gotten away from what I'll call the kind of the bell curve syndrome. And actually, I'm not the only person thinking of this. I mean, this is well developed in Taleb's book, The Black Swan, that in order to quantify risk, you know, back when Frank Knight first analyzed risk, he said, you know, risk is something you can measure. Uncertainty is something you can't. You know, that's what we call Knightian uncertainty, is something you just, you can't conceive of. You just know it's out there somewhere. It's outside of the realm of possibility. And all the possibilities that you face can be captured in this distribution, what we call the bell curve. And the most likely thing is the middle, which is your base case that you present to your board. And then companies then will explore those events, potential scenarios in the top part or the bottom part of that bell curve to satisfy the board that they're prepared for good news or bad news relative to their base case. That's basic good practice. But I think what I'm arguing here is that the bell curve, as Taleb said, is not really the relevant way to think about risk. Because actually, when we remember history, almost every big event we can remember was way outside of the bell curve.
Right.
So history is literally driven by things that happened outside of the bell curves. And so we need to be more thinking about more uniform distributions where we think, roughly speaking, this is what's going to happen. But we need to be literally prepared to shift course, you know, 2 or 3 months from now, because we've had a couple of realizations that tell us we're to the left or we're to the right of where we thought we'd be. So we need to have the kind of resilience that quite literally, not hypothetically, but literally can deal with these possibilities. And that, of course, is good luck as well as bad. The problem with economics is it reduces everything down to this kind of statistical distribution based on history, which is essentially a bell curve around each of the things that you're speaking to. It misses the ability to actually describe how you will deal with the actual outcomes. So economists talk about this will be 2.4. Well, okay, 2.4, that's their base case. But literally the spread, they don't convey to people what the spread could be. And that spread has a lot of information in it for a company that's doing its planning. But often that's not given any publicity at all. In fact, the economist that says, I don't know if it's going to be 2.3, but I think it could be anywhere between 0 and 5. Well, then they're just saying, well, that's just one hand, other hand stuff. I don't, you know, you're not telling me anything. But actually, that economist is telling you something. He's telling you that the uncertainty is really elevated, and you need to be prepared for both ends of that distribution.
And that marks quite a significant shift in the whole management approach that people have to companies, because we are talking about moving into a period where, yes, resilience is hugely important, because we are not going to be able to predict with the same degree of certainty some of the changes that might be coming along. And yet there will be an expectation, perhaps from our shareholders, perhaps from our boards, that we're able to navigate our way through that. And certainly we did see, didn't we, during the pandemic, a number of companies really demonstrate their ability to do that exceptionally well, you know, through moving staff into home environments, increasing their agility, and so on. So the good news, I guess, is that there are very many organizations out there and people running them that do have some of these skill sets. Is it the sort of thing that can be taught, do you think, or is it something that we're going to need to learn on the job over a period of time?
Well, you cite some excellent examples that happened during the pandemic. I, too, was very impressed with that. And from where I was sitting, which was in the governor's chair, I had this sense that many economies, and I was, of course, focusing mainly on Canadian economy, that companies in the Canadian economy were actually in really good position. It's as if, you know, a healthy individual that contracts COVID has a much higher probability of just shaking it off than someone who's already got a pre-existing condition. And similarly for the economy in Canada, we were at, you know, a 40-year low for unemployment, and we were at exactly 2% inflation, exactly on target, home, as I describe it. So you can't get any more resilient than this. Mm-hmm. Maybe balance sheets could have been in better shape. There was a lot of debt, so I'll give that one away. But in much better condition than we'd been in previous years. And so when the shock came, I wasn't that surprised that the economy demonstrated resilience. And it came from many sources, not just the preparation. But in the end, can it be learned? I think we learned a lot from that actual episode. And there are a lot of going forward takeaways. People will never now underinvest in their ability to run their business remotely, will they? You know, there was a little bit of scrambling. People were buying laptops by the truckful,
right?
Which is one of the reasons why we've got the chip shortage now. Everybody in the company is equipped both at work and at home. Well, that's twice as many laptops and almost than we had before. And, you know, there's a chip in your exercise bike besides. So, you know, the next thing you know, that's a lot of chips. So we learned from that. And what's happened then, of course, is, you know, I work for a law firm, Osler, Hoskin, Harcourt. Well, I know we are not going to go back to the days when we negotiated a deal in London and travel over there for 2 days per week for 6 weeks in a row in order to finish that deal. We will do all of that virtually, like you and I are talking right now. And we're just going to fly over maybe at the very beginning, and we're going to fly over at the very end to have champagne when it's open.
Right.
But I think in between, you're going to save all this money, not just money, but time on airplanes and so on. And so that's a major fundamental shift in the way we do business. And that's just one example. It's everywhere. So there will be permanent changes that I think are guaranteed to be higher productivity as a result of what we've been through. That's a form of resilience. It's not measured yet. If you ask statistical agencies, they'll say, well, I can't find any productivity in the data. They never can. When you go around the economy, you hear all these stories about how firms have boosted their productivity, and it's everywhere. I tell you, Steve, it's everywhere except in the statistics. And so we worry about productivity because I think we're not really able to measure it properly. In the end, I think we're going to come out of this feeling better about it. Now, there'll be people still in the bottom part of that K as a consequence of what I just said. And so we need great societal tools to help them find their way to the top part of the K much faster than has happened in past industrial revolutions. Because there's going to be a steady flow of people into the bottom part of the K over the next few years.
And I sense, and this comes through in your book, that you have a pretty high degree of optimism for the future, despite all of the uncertainties, despite all of the risks, the changes that we're going through. Would that be fair? I mean, I read the book and was expecting to come away and you know, be quite sort of downcast, perhaps. But actually, it's quite uplifting in terms of some of the solutions that you offer and your perspective.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because of course, when people see the title, most people just don't like uncertainty at all. They will happily pay a price to make uncertainty go away. And it's why when you see two economists on television, one says the interest rates are going to be 2% a year from now. And the other one says, I don't know, interest rates could be between 1% and 3% a year from now. People glom onto the person that said they're going to be 2% because it's taken uncertainty off the table and it's given them a direct answer to a question. Makes them sound authoritative and so on. And I say, well, actually, the other one's giving more information. It's allowing for the possibility. You need to at least be prepared for 3% and be prepared for 1%. So think it through and make sure when you decide to buy that house, you're going to be okay. It's a very simple parable. And I know economists will say, you know, on average, everything's going to be fine. So that's like saying, don't worry, you can walk right across that river because on average, it's only 12 inches deep. You know, well, you know, it could be 60 feet deep in the very middle.
Yep.
And that's a big problem for trying to walk across it. And so what I like to remind people is that we know if we think about history, even for a minute, what we know is that the good luck has vastly outweighed the bad luck through time. Primary driver of that is, you know, human ingenuity and technological progress. That's the progress line. And there's every reason to actually expect that line to pick up speed over the next 10 years. The difference, though, is that we're understanding better that there's a lot of volatility around that line, and we need to be prepared for both sides. And so if my book helps people have a coherent conversation around the table, whether it's a boardroom table or the kitchen table, then that's I've achieved what I've tried to do, to help people understand the uncertainties that they face better. But they should be fundamentally optimistic, because that's exactly what history tells us. And our ability to deal with uncertainty is just one step away. It's always just that bit of ingenuity. And I think when there's this much money at stake, that ingenuity is Mother Nature at work. You know, we will adapt to this higher level of volatility as we've adapted to things in the past. My goodness, look what policymakers did for us during the pandemic. You know, this is, remember that in March or in April of 2020, I remember a headline that said, the worst recession since the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. That was an economist forecast. And look what we had instead. Okay. Now, that's much better performance from policymakers than what we saw even, you know, in 2008, and far better than past major economic episodes. So those folks are getting better at their craft, for sure. And look, as you mentioned, the examples of companies. Look how companies have managed through this. Yes, there's been supportive policies to make it easier, but that's, of course, everybody on the team did their thing. Banks in Canada, banks stepped up and gave folks mortgage holidays, issued new credit as opposed to restricting credit as they've done in past major crises. It was a very, very important difference to help stabilize everything. So everything's getting better. And we should be happy at that outcome. And we should be thinking that we're going to have a preponderance of good luck in the future. But be prepared to be, you know, step into the deep water here and there. Learn how to swim so you have more resilience when you step into the deep water.
Stephen, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing some of those insights. And for anybody who's listening and wants to read the book, it is out now. As I say, it was out at the end of February. Well worth a read. So thank you very much indeed for spending time.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks to this week's guest, Stephen Poloz. It was nice to have some optimism grounded in data. Next week, Steve speaks with Alexander Sager, head of the Cybercrime Division for the Council of Europe. Here's a preview.
There is much more openness that we also see by private sector entities to discuss this, to whether they actually report in a specific case. Is that another story, but that's what I'm saying. We need to create a dynamic where that goes in a positive direction, where also entities see, okay, others have been hit, others have cooperated, they managed to investigate, prosecute, recover some of the proceeds and so on. And then hopefully in this way, you will also get much more cooperation in the future and makes it more disruption of ransomware, more convictions also, hopefully, of offenders. And then I think we're on a good track.
We'll be back for the full conversation in a week. In the meantime, is there a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org which is also where you can find that catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. Follow us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And if you like the ISF podcast, we'd love it if you'd write a short review and if you'd rate the podcast. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, associate producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.